the court will proceed to the third case of the day, the United States versus Sandoval Vasquez.
Good morning, Your Honors. If it pleases
Mr. Lopez.
Good morning, sir. Your Honors, my name is Joseph Lopez. I represent the appellant. I was appointed by the district court. Largely, judges, this is a situation that I'd first like to begin with the Fourth Amendment issue that we previously raised. In this case, as the court knows, there was an unrelated narcotics investigation in another area of Chicago, which resulted in a seizure of some cocaine. One of the officers that was engaged in the surveillance was ordered to stop a vehicle that was seen leaving the area. The vehicle was stopped on Madison Street. The individual that was driving the vehicle, Mr. Morales, was able to provide a tip to the Chicago police officer, who then radioed in to other officers. The tip basically indicated that there was a vehicle parked at a location belonging to the appellant, and that the vehicle had earlier been used to retrieve some of the cocaine which was sold at the unrelated site. Thereafter, the officers conducted a surveillance. One officer conducted the surveillance. During the surveillance, the officer did note that he saw a truck that appeared to match the description that he was previously given. He didn't see anybody go near the truck, open the truck, or do anything to the truck. What Officer DeSalvo saw was the truck being moved from one location to another location and being blocked in by another vehicle. Now, the issue in this case, the government has argued that it was an open business premise, and I recognize Tolar and I recognize the open premise doctrine, and I understand that. But in this case, there's a couple of issues that we think go beyond Tolar, one of which is, was this reasonable? And it has to be reasonable under the Fourth Amendment.
Well, let's talk about this this entry, though. Now, you would agree that if the entry had been made in the middle of the business day, it wouldn't have been a problem.
I think that I agree that it wouldn't have been a problem if it would have been conducted in a different manner, in a peaceful manner, like in other cases that have come before this court.
So then on this question of being the business being close to being closed, which I think was one of the arguments, you're saying that's not an argument, that's out of the mix now? The issue of it, the business almost being closed, you will concede that the business was open.
The business was open. What the officer and I think the sergeant said was it appeared that the workers were preparing to close this business.
Right, but it was still open.
It apparently was still open to a certain degree, and once again, the truck had been moved and was blocked in the back.
I understand. I just wanted to get your position, though, because close to closing is not closed. So you're not arguing that it was closed.
Well, what I'm arguing is that I believe that the people inside the business premise were basically communicating that they were expecting some privacy by them making arrangements to close this door in this particular case. What happens in this case is you have an hour that goes by where the officers are making the observation. Now, the way they enter, according to Sergeant McHugh, he gave the order to let's roll, and they did roll. They rolled with guns out, with jackets that said CPD, screaming and yelling at the occupants in the business, and they basically roped them all up with handcuffs and let them sit on a floor for over an hour. And these are people that weren't even connected to anything that the officers had at the time that they made their entry. Their focus seemed to be, once they went in, they wanted to secure the premises. They did nothing in an hour, like in Patino, to get a telephonic search warrant, which is the preferred method of entry in this district. They didn't do anything. They entered armed, and they entered with a purpose, and they were exerting force as they entered into the premise. They wanted these people to know they had the upper hand in this case. They had the upper hand, and they had all the accoutrements of authority with them. Badges, clothing that emblazoned with the CPD symbol on it, and they had weapons. Then we get into the situation when other officers arrived. I think the FBI officer arrived, said that they were wearing plastic gloves, which indicated they were previously searching the premises. So once we get into this non-consensual encounter, because nobody invited the police in, the police weren't there to conduct business, the police were there to search a van. They get in there, and now they have everybody tied up. And there's also issues as to what was said inside there with Officer DeSalvo, who was significantly impeached with some very strong omissions from his case report. For instance, that the defendant made a statement regarding a gun that wasn't contained in the case report. And that is almost impossible to believe, because that's such an important factor that I think even a rookie police officer would have included it in his report. And it's impeachment by omission. I cited an old case, the Standard Oil case, which I've used. A lot of people don't even know the case exists, but I've used it in other jurisdictions and in the circuit court. And it's a well-reasoned case, and it's based on Wigmore, and it's based on the principles of evidence. And impeachment by omission, when a fact should be asserted in a report, such as the questions I asked him that weren't in there, I think that you can draw the inference that that didn't really happen, because that's such an important fact that would be inside the document itself. And this weakened the credibility of the statements that the officer indicated the defendant made. Now, obviously, there's another issue with a Terry stop. This was well beyond a Terry stop, and Terry versus Ohio, as this court has heard probably ad nauseum, allows the officers to make a brief investigatory stop and conduct an interview if the person's willing to listen and is willing to ask questions. But this didn't happen in this case. This is a full-blown raid. It's another assault by the Chicago police in their effort on the war on drugs to target the Fourth Amendment and to make the Fourth Amendment not applicable. And they used it as a doormat to come into the appellant's business in the manner in which they went. And it was coercive in nature, and it was designed to get compliance, which leads us to the voluntariness issue of the consent to search. Now, there was an issue about this consent to search, whether it was an oral consent to search made to the police officers, or did the appellant later on actually sign a written consent form, and did he do so voluntary? Well, first of all, we have to look at the coercive nature and the tactics of the police in this case by running into this business premise, hitching everybody up, ordering them to remain on the floor, and then further interrogating everybody. A period of time goes by. The defendant eventually, the lower court found, that there was an intervening circumstance in regard to this arrest. And the intervening circumstance was the arrival of the FBI agent that was somehow supposed to sanitize what happened earlier. But all it did was make it worse, because now you go from being in the custody of the Chicago Police Department with all their attendant errors and fouls that they engage in, and now you're in the hands of the most powerful law enforcement agency in the world. So it becomes even more coercive in this regard. And the defendant testified about how he felt and what he felt, and we believe that the consent to search was not shown to be voluntary. It's on the government to prove that this consent is voluntary. You have to look at all the attending circumstances around it, and we don't think that they met their burden. Because
one of the big circumstances was the fact that at that point he was advised of his rights when the FBI came. And another big factor is, without being asked, he voluntarily talked about the trap compartment and how it opened, because they were having difficulty opening that. Doesn't that go to the whole question of whether or not there was consent?
Well, and I understand it's a good question, because it's my opinion that the damage is already done. And once you break the threshold of your voluntariness, it doesn't matter whether he sat down and wrote a tome regarding all of his drug dealing activity. Prior to that is where the illegal conduct came, and prior to that is where the coercive nature came. So what he said, I think, subsequently, I don't think should be used to bootstrap to show that he voluntarily consented. Because you have to understand, he had family members inside this business premise. He had employees inside this business premise. And all of a sudden, around 4:20 on a normal working business day, in comes CPD with four or five cars rolling up on the premises, terrifying the living daylights out of everybody with this type of conduct. This is not the type of conduct that we should condone in allowing officers to roll up on business premises. If they want to come in peacefully and amicably, like they have in other cases, I don't see the harm in that. And if the people are willing to speak and willing to answer questions, well, so be it. That's how it is. But in this case, we have conduct that goes way beyond that. There's not even any exigency in this case to justify this. The police created their own exigency by waiting outside for a period of time. They created the exigency. There was constant communication. There was radio calls, telephone calls, communication between the two parties, because There's something going up on the north side, and there's something going down here on the south side, so there's communication between everybody. Any exigency in this case is fabricated by the police. And then
there was something like more than 40 kilos of cocaine that was discovered here. Is that correct?
I think it was about 65.
And what's the value of all that cocaine?
I guess it depends on how good of a deal you get, but I'm sure it's over $1 million. If we figure conservatively 20,000 a kilo, that's 1.2 million or more.
So if you're expecting to, police are expecting to enter a premise and they know there's $1 million+ worth of cocaine there, or suspect there is it reasonable to assume that if you're talking about that volume of cocaine, that maybe there's protection and all that sort of stuff? It's different than coming into a place when you think there's somebody smoking a joint or something. It's a big difference, isn't it?
Well, you're
faulting the Chicago cops for coming in with a show of force, and maybe that's not unreasonable with there's that much cocaine, or they suspect there's that much cocaine there, and that usually means protection and guns and all that sort of stuff would be on the premises.
Well, they had no information that anybody was armed in the premises, and from what they could observe, all they observed was totally innocent conduct of people working in the iron working business. Had they had a tip that went along with their original tip that these people are armed and dangerous, then I guess I'd have to agree to you, but In all experiences, many times there's no weapons or security involved. They could have easily got a warrant and stayed outside the premises. The cocaine wouldn't have went anywhere because they were there. But instead, they chose to shortcut the process. I mean, the Fourth Amendment protects people and not places. I understand that. And the defendant has a Fourth Amendment right, and his Fourth Amendment right was violated in this case.
I just had one other question with respect to the standing problem. How do you respond to the government's argument that your client was not the owner of the van and therefore he didn't have standing to object anyway?
Well, it's clear he wasn't the owner, but there was a bailment created between him and the owner of cocaine, and I think if you have a bailment, you have standing in a bailment situation. He testified that the van was going to be given to him and that he was being paid a certain amount, and if he's responsible...
Well, it was going to be given to him, but it was not his at the time.
But he was under the care, custody, and control of him at the time. He was the one that had it in his business, and you could show that he has standing because it was moved in his business to a different location, so he was actually constructively possessing the cocaine by allowing it to be inside his premises. And I think if you're in constructive possession of cocaine, that you have standing to object to an unreasonable search and a seizure, especially a warrantless search and seizure, as in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Lopez. Mr. Shaw?
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Manish Shah, and I represent the United States. The district court here considered all of the factors that Mr. Lopez has been relying on and evaluated those factors, evaluated the testimony of the witness, including the defendant, who the district court ultimately found committed perjury, in deciding that what happened here was reasonable, that the consent that the defendant gave was voluntary. And those factors included the fact that the defendant was a CPD informant and had told the police, I'm an informant for the CPD. I'm in the middle of a marijuana deal. And the CPD said, well, we're here for something else. We're here about this van. The defendant was cooperative, and it is absolutely appropriate to consider the defendant's actions after he signed the written consent as part of the totality of circumstances in evaluating how he gave that consent. And the fact that he gave a lengthy statement detailing the offloading of cocaine at his business, his financial relationship with the co-defendant, the fact that he identified other locations where cocaine was offloaded and drove or directed the agent to that location after the fact, all goes to the totality of the circumstances, where we have a defendant who is aware of police procedures. He has a criminal history. He has a relationship with a CPD officer as an informant. And he's confronted, and he chooses voluntarily to cooperate.
to give them. What about Mr. Lopez's argument that there was such a short period of time between the, you know, unlawful questioning, which you pretty much concede as well, that Sergeant McHugh questioning wasn't appropriate, but then the FBI agent comes in, you know, he talks about that short expanse of time. Was that really an intervening event?
I think there are essentially two responses to that, Your Honor. One is that there frankly doesn't need to be an intervening event when the initial event itself is not coercive. It's not that his statement to Sergeant McHugh was not a coerced statement. He had testified that he had been threatened by Sergeant McHugh, that Sergeant McHugh had said, if you don't talk, if you don't consent, we're going to arrest everyone here. That was false testimony, and Judge Holdman found that no threat had actually occurred. So there was no act or unlawful act that had overcome the defendant's will at that point. So when the FBI agents come, there doesn't need to be an intervening act. It's all part of the one totality of the circumstances. But even if there were unlawful conduct such that there could be or needed to be an intervening act, yes, there absolutely was one here, because as you look at the circumstances, when the FBI arrived, the whole tone changed. And this is what Judge Holdman found, that Agent Emai and the other FBI agents arrived with, they were informed that the defendant wanted to cooperate. And as Agent Emai testified, I said, okay, well, let's get our forms. Let's sit him down. Let's go over these forms. Let's have the Spanish-speaking officer present go over that with him. And that is sufficient under these circumstances where you don't have an overwhelming or flagrant action of police misconduct, and you do have circumstances that indicate the defendant's comfort with the FBI. It is enough under these circumstances to say that this was a voluntary interaction with the agents and with law enforcement. The initial entry into the business is really, I think, at this point not an issue. It's not a Fourth Amendment event, the entry into the open business premises. What the circumstances and the manner of entry that the defense objects to, that goes to consent, and that's exactly how the district court factored that into its ruling. The manner that the police entered the premises was a factor that the district court considered in evaluating whether the defendant voluntarily consented to the search of his premises. There are a number of alternative bases to support the search in any event, including the lack of standing that Judge Williams, you raised with counsel. The defendant didn't own this vehicle, and more importantly, for Fourth Amendment purposes, did he have an expectation of privacy? And that's what we're talking about when we're talking about standing. And on that vehicle, he didn't. He didn't own it. He may be expected to own it in the future, but he also had his co-defendant, Miguel Morales, who was the owner of the van, who had complete and free, total permission to come and go as he wanted, to access the van, to offload kilos of cocaine from that van. The defendant could have stored, you know, his most personal private possessions in that van, and he couldn't expect any privacy over it. He had other people who had free access to it. He didn't have an expectation of privacy in the van, and so he didn't have standing to challenge the search of it. And also, there was, as the district court found, probable cause to search the van. The information that the CPD had prior to entering the business was that Miguel Morales had just delivered 6 kilos of cocaine to another location. He had been confronted. He said, well, I got the 6 kilos from a van, and there are a lot more kilos in that van. The van looks like this, and he gave a description. And the van is located at this business. The officers go there, and they see exactly the van fitting that description at that location. And that is probable cause. That's enough information that has been corroborated to suggest a fair possibility that there is cocaine in that van. And in terms of quantity, there were 6 kilos that were recovered at the initial location. Morales said there was a lot more in the van, and what was ultimately found in the van were 24 kilos. The defendant's statement was there was originally 42 kilos in the van. Morales had come and gone a few times leading up to the 6 kilos. So there was plenty of information to suggest that there was a lot of cocaine trafficking going on at this location, such that, one, there was probable cause to search the van, no need for a warrant because the automobile exception would apply, And two, the manner of entry was entirely reasonable, as Judge Holdeman found. This is a case where there's a lot of cocaine involved, unknown individuals in an open business premises coming and going. It was absolutely incumbent upon the CPD to act appropriately to secure the premises and find out what's going on and conduct a reasonable investigation, which was enter, secure, find out who the owner of this premises is, and once the owner is identified, talk with him. And they did that, and he cooperated. He understood what was going on, understood how these investigations work, and agreed to cooperate as best he could, and that's exactly what he did. For those reasons and the reasons set forth in our brief, we would ask that the court affirm the defendant's conviction and sentence.
Thank you, Mr. Shaw. Mr. Lopez?
Just a few words, Your Honor. Thank you for allowing me to come back. Once again, we get back to the question of the reasonableness of the entire encounter that we have in this case. There isn't anything wrong with an officer or other officers, whether they're local or state or federal, to go into a premise and begin asking people questions. But when you roll into the premises like they did here, with the guns drawn, jackets that say CPD, yelling CPD, and arresting people before they find anything, this is clearly a violation. And that's what the focus is. And it's clearly a violation because this isn't the type of conduct, regardless of whether they're looking for drugs or stolen refrigerators, I don't think it really matters. What matters is what is the conduct and what is reasonable under the Fourth Amendment. And this defendant or appellant did have a reasonable expectation of privacy in his business premises as he was closing it up. The van was moved into a location that wasn't accessible to the public, and that's where we're at again. And we believe, once again, that this was a violation of the defendant's Fourth Amendment right and that the evidence should be suppressed in this case, which would be, and I apologize to the court about the quantity of kilos. I do so many cases, sometimes I forget which ones are what quantities. But regardless, it's still close to $1 million. That in this instance, we believe the court should suppress the kilos, the statements, and the weapon that was found at the location because the weapon was used as an enhancement in the sentencing. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to all counsel. Mr. Lopez, you accepted appointment in this case, and I want to give you an additional thanks from the court for your strong and able performance.
It's always a pleasure.
Thank you. Case is taken under advisement.